everybody. We've reached the 10th episode of A Journey Through Aussie Pop. I'm Gavin Scott from chartbeats.com.au and my co-host is Robbie Molinari from Turn the Beat Around on Joy 94.9 in Melbourne. Hi, Robbie.
Hi, Gavin, and a big g'day and thanks to everyone who has joined us along the way or might just be tuning in for the first time. What we do here is take a closer look at some standout moments in Aussie pop music history and let the singers tell their stories themselves.
And in this episode, we're looking at a band who straddled the pop-rock divide. They definitely had a foot in each genre, so much so that their debut album was called Ish, because they were a bit pop-ish, a little bit rock-ish. Robbie, I can only be talking about one band, can't I?
Yes, it's Midnight Oil. Actually, I'm kidding. It's 1927, of course, who seemingly came out of nowhere to take Australia by storm in 1988. Let's take a quick listen to their biggest hit, If I Could.
If I Could.
The second single by 1927, which we'll talk about in more detail a little later on. But before that, the band's lead singer, Eric Wiedemann, is going to take us back to where it all began. Well, for him at least. And that was on the iconic Hey Hey It's Saturday.
Yes, Eric went on to the variety show's talent search segment called Red Faces after a friend dared him to. He'd been playing around Melbourne in various bands and doing a bit of solo work and thought, yeah, okay, well, why not? Despite finding the odd star now and then, though, Red Faces wasn't exactly known for showcasing musical talent, was it?
No, not at all. Look, Red Faces was probably more known for showcasing slapstick comedy, and then you had the Red Simons element of bringing people right down, which in a roundabout way was sometimes the highlight of the segment. But then on the other occasion, as you mentioned, like in Eric Wiedemann's case, it unveiled some amazing talent.
Yeah, in 1986, there was a guy called Barry Michael, and he ended up with a record deal, and his song, I Don't Understand Where I Fit In, reached the top 40. Eric was another one of those cases where it was obvious he was really good and not, you know, like those bunch of guys pretending to be bobsled team.
And very, very strangely, Eric was fortunate to complete his entire performance of The Police's Roxanne. He wasn't gonged off by Red Simons. And the judging panel weren't the only ones impressed. Gary Frost, a former member of Moving Pictures, was watching at home and liked the sound of Eric.
Now, Eric chatted to us just before heading back out on the road for 1927's latest tour. You can head to 1927.net.au for all the dates. So let's let him take the story from here. To kick us off, we will get the Hey Hey story out of the way.
Yep.
I know you were dared to go on the show, but even though it was a dare and I assume it was, you know, a little bit of fun, was it still nerve-wracking at all?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, when I was younger, I had this, I guess, you know, a fear of authority, or I kind of figured that, yeah, there was this other world of people that made rules and whatever. So I was always a little bit shy about that. So, you know, when I was basically told that, oh, look, I've booked you to go on this Red Faces show, I would rather not have done it. But because I figured it's just not the right thing to do to try and back out of this thing because it's organized. So I went ahead with it. But I was terrified. When you're used to singing through a microphone and a PA and you're basically standing there with nothing, yeah, it's kind of daunting.
I've read two different stories. I've read that Gary saw you on TV and drove all the way from Sydney to Melbourne, but then I've also read that he called Channel 9. How did he get in touch with you? And when he did get in touch, what was his pitch?
First it was the phone call. Yeah, so I got the phone call from Channel 9 saying that this guy had called and he's putting a band together to make a record in Sydney, and, you know, he thinks I'd be the right vocalist for the thing. So when they told me who it was, from this guy from Moving Pictures, it was like, you know, because I didn't really like Moving Pictures at all. So, but, you know, for the sake of the experience, I just went, sure. So he came down, we had a chat, and I agreed to move up to Sydney. So packed up the combi and off I went, and spent the next, I think, 12 months or so writing songs with Gary and just working out things, and then we jumped into the studio and made that record, which also took about another 12 months.
That was a pretty good pitch to get you to move city, even though you didn't like the band he'd previously been in that much. I don't know, he must have been pretty convincing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very convincing, actually. Yeah. For me, I mean, all I'd been doing in Melbourne was, you know, first there was this cover band thing, and then I did a little time just playing solo in some bars and whatnot. So the opportunity to do something bigger and different, it was worth a try. I mean, you know, what's the worst that could happen? He could fall into a screaming heap of shit, you know, and I could just go home again.
Did everything kind of slot into place quite easily, or were there teething problems?
No, there were no problems at all. I mean, the band was, you know, Gary Frost, and he enlisted his brother Bill, or Phil. His name is Phil, but there was another Phil in the band originally, so we called him Bill. Yeah, we just played together. No one had any issues with it, with anything. And for the rest of us, because Gary had done it all before, you know, so he was like a, I guess you could say, like a veteran or whatever. But for the rest of us, it was just a, you know, whoa, look at this. This is fun, because none of us had done anything like it before.
So then you were signed to Charles Fisher's label, Trafalgar. Had other labels shown an interest as you were kind of putting stuff together?
No, as a matter of fact, all of them, because we went to see them all, and yeah, nobody wanted to pick up on it, which is why Charles Fisher basically said, well, I'll sign you to Trafalgar, which was a, you know, an independent label, and we'll just do a P&E deal with one of the majors, which they went, yeah, sure, we'll distribute the thing as long as you don't have to pay for anything. So,
and so what had you taken out to all the other labels? Had you taken things like That's When I Think of You and If I Could to them?
Yep, and Compulsory Hero as well, yeah, all of them.
Wow.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it?
It is. They must have been kicking themselves later.
Oh, not really. Everybody made money.
Putting those demos together and then later the album, how easily did yours and Gary's songwriting partnership come together? Did that come together quite naturally?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it was later it was largely influenced by Charles Fisher, because he really liked what I – sometimes Gary had written a song and, you know, there'd be something that just wasn't quite complete or right or whatever. And so quite often what I would suggest, Charles Fisher would say, that's a really good idea. So he really encouraged that collaboration more than anybody else. But initially, yeah, we wrote together quite easily.
But it was sometimes not necessarily you sitting down and starting a song together. It was maybe a song that Gary had written that you would then add to.
More often than not, it was either my idea or his idea, and then we'd embellish it together, yeah.
So the band was formed and signed by producer Charles Fisher, and they came up with their name 1927. In fact, they pulled it out of a hat. It was one of a number of options that they'd written down, and it came from a saying that Gary Frost had. He used to say things like, I haven't done that since 1927, or such and such hasn't happened since 1927.
Right. Now, with everything in place, it was time to release their debut single, That's When I Think of You. Let's take a quick listen. That's When I Think of You would set 1927 off in exactly the right direction. The song became a hit single and would end up peaking at number 6 on the ARIA singles chart.
For me, That's When I Think of You was right in that sweet spot of Aussie pop rock that I like. Alongside bands like Crowded House, Noiseworks, Models and so on, it wasn't exactly the Angels, was it?
No, I was instantly hooked on That's When I Think of You. I loved that track and I still do. For me, it's probably my most favourite 1927 song.
They kind of appealed to everyone. My sister bought the album and she was into The Cure and Madness, The Radiators. Wow. And she even liked 1927. They, you know, had very broad appeal.
Mass appeal.
All right, let's hear from Eric about the decision to launch with That's When I Think of You.
That's When I Think of You was right at the very beginning, actually. I think it was possibly one of the first. No, To Love Me was the very first track that we did. So we went through two drummers while we were in the studio. The first drummer was Phil Campbell, who used to drum with Electric Pandas, but when it came down to actually recording the record as opposed to the demos, he kind of went, you know what, I'm not into this. So he just kind of went, you know, sorry, but I've got to go. So then a guy called John Carson stepped in, and we started recording with live drums, and I think we got maybe three tracks, like To Love Me, Give a Kid a Break, and I think The Mess had live drums on them. And when it came down to doing things like That's When I Think of You, the more straight kind of songs, it just wasn't happening. So we switched to drum machine, and there was a little bit of a hoo-ha there from the drummer. So he left, and then we got another drummer, which was James Barton. But the first few tracks were the ones with the live drums, and then after that came the other ones. And That's When I Think of You, I think, was the first one we recorded with Lynn drum as opposed to a real drum.
And was there a sense of excitement about that song compared to the others? Did it stand out, or was it just a, yep, this is another good song?
No, none of them did, you know. They all sounded great, but it wasn't like, oh, that's a hit song, or this is going to change the world for us. There was no sense of that at all, really.
What was it like working with Charles? Was he like a good mentor, or did he push you?
Oh, he was fantastic. I've worked with a couple of producers since, and they can't hold a candle to Charles. He's what I consider to be a real record producer. He gets involved with the musicians. He likes to get immersed in what the band thinks they're about and try and project that onto the record. And also he gets actively involved in sometimes arrangements where it's just like, well, you know, there's a bit missing or it doesn't do what it should do here. And, you know, we would work through it. A lot of the songs changed, not dramatically, but a little bit from, you know, original demo stage to final stage. And that was mostly due to Charles Fisher.
Was there any debate about which single to have as the debut?
Well, not so much a debate, but I mean, I had my ideas and Bill had his ideas, and ultimately the record company had their ideas, and their ideas were definitely the wiser choice.
What was your idea?
I was thinking like Propaganda Machine. God knows why.
And was anyone saying we should go with If I Could, or was there a sense of, no, we need to hold that back?
Before That's When I Think of You was released, If I Could was already going to be the second single. And because I was green, naive, learning, whatever you want to call it, I didn't understand the dynamics of the protocol for releasing singles and albums and all that sort of thing back in the day was really important. Historically, you know, you release your breakthrough single, so people go, oh, who the hell's this? And historically, the second single is always the one that seems to do best. So that was the thinking in, you know, releasing If I Could next.
What are your memories of filming that first music video for That's When I Think of You? It's very dark.
Oh, it was bloody cold. We were out at Camden. There's this little airfield out there, and some guy had a shed with a couple of, you know, nice old planes. I think one was a Spitfire and a Hurricane and that kind of thing. Real collector's pieces. So we got permission to shoot down there, but it was just a cold, long day. I hate making videos. But yeah, I hated it from the onset. It was like, oh God, do I have to do this again? Like, really?
Is that why 1927 had a number of live videos?
Quite possibly, yeah.
Then you don't actually have to film anything new.
Yeah, or pretend, you know. And I was like, oh God, I hate pretending.
Had you been styled at all for that video, or for, you know, in photo shoots and things like that? Or was what we saw kind of what you all were?
That's pretty much what we were. And looking back, you know, at myself especially, it's like, whoa. Yeah, funny. I think we all felt that, you know, none of us had any kind of particular style at all. And, you know, when you look back, it's like, wow, yeah, it's not what I expected to see.
It was kind of, I guess, understated. It's like jeans and shirts and pretty, no one had crazy hair.
Yeah, no, we were quite determined not to be a dress-up band.
So the single comes out, goes to number six, and I've heard you speak before in an interview about it seeming like it was happening to someone else. Does that still hold true for you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, even now, that person that gets up on stage and sings and makes records and all that kind of thing, it's like another, it's like a different person to me, because I'm not that person. Oh, you know, I'm still not that comfortable with crowds and whatever else, but yeah, it's hard to describe.
Like a kind of alter ego kind of thing?
No, not really an alter ego. I mean, quite often, you know, I'll be with my wife down at the Coles or whatever, and, you know, just walking through, and she'll be like, "Was that your song?" And you know, my song will be playing in the supermarket. And it's, I don't think of it as me, and she doesn't think of it as me either, actually, because she's like, she knows me, the person me, not the 1927 guy, you know. So, yeah, I draw a pretty solid line between that guy and me.
Now, as we heard, 1927 had If I Could up their sleeve and released the ballad as their second single. We all know the song would go on to achieve classic status. It's an Aussie anthem. It would eclipse the success of That's When I Think of You and become an even bigger hit, reaching a peak of number four on the charts.
It's pretty much a perfect pop rock song, right?
Absolutely. There is nothing wrong with this song.
And there's something so heartfelt and non-cynical about it. Mm, even all these years later, it still packs a real emotional punch. I remember about a decade ago, I went to see 1927 play, and the crowd went off to If I Could. People were on their feet, arms around each other, swaying, singing along, smiling at strangers. It was like a religious experience, especially this bit of the song.
And I tell you what, that is a great karaoke track also. Let's go back to Eric as he tells us his thoughts on If I Could.
I thought it was a schmaltzy love ballad, and I still think of it as, well, it is. It's a schmaltzy love ballad. That's what it is. And some of the greatest songs in the world are schmaltzy love ballads. So, yeah, I don't dislike it, but that's what I think of it.
Can you sense that reaction when you're on stage, that it really means something to people?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's one of the major reasons that I do this, because to move somebody that way through music, I mean, it's a great thing. I feel that when I'm performing it. Like, I won't perform a song unless I feel something about it. Let's put it that way. So yeah, it's a beautiful song, and yeah, I know that how special it is to a lot of people, and so, you know, every time I perform that song, I try and honor that. You know what I mean?
Did everyone know it was going to be as huge as it was?
Oh, hell no. No, none of us had any idea that any of this was going to go the way, you know. I mean, the fact that I'm talking to you here like 34 years later, no, you can't crystal ball that shit.
Not even after That's When I Think of You did so well?
No, you know, because it could be a one-off. I mean, look, the first time I heard it on the radio, I remember it well. I was with Bill. Yeah, it came on the radio, and we were just like two crazy little kids that, you know, just found a fresh pack of chewing gum on the ground, you know. It was just, yeah, it was funny. And that was enough for us. It was like, wow, we've got a song on the radio. That was cool. We didn't expect anything more than that.
With the album Ish now available, it was time to release a third single. And next up was You'll Never Know. You'll Never Know reached number 15, and the fourth single, Compulsory Hero, did slightly better, peaking at number 14.
Another two solid singles there, and Compulsory Hero in particular holds an important place in many fans' hearts because it deals with the experience of going to war. Unlike the three other singles, which are love songs, this resonated in a different way, especially with people who either had served or had family members that had served.
Absolutely. And look, another very strong song. It tugs at the heartstrings, like If I Could does, but in that different way that you explained. For me, I think it's got the What About Me's about it. Because, I mean, Gary Frost, he wrote both, and it's got that solo acoustic piano playing throughout. It just resonates in exactly the same way that that classic song did. But Compulsory Hero, another great song, another Aussie anthem. And let's hear what Eric has to say about the track.
I thought Compulsory Hero was a great, great, great song because, yeah, it wasn't a love song. It was, you know, it had subject matter that meant something. Incidentally, Ish was originally going to be, because we were all big fans of Pink Floyd, so it was originally going to be a concept album, so that there would be a string running through the whole thing. And it was about war. So we had Compulsory Hero, All the People, which was, you know, like a rejoice kind of thing. That's What I Think of You was about a guy in the trenches. If I Could was obviously a love letter home. So we were aiming for that kind of thing, but in the end, yeah, we kind of just dropped that idea.
Why did that idea get dropped?
We couldn't, you know, the other songs like To Love Me and You'll Never Know, A Propaganda Machine kind of fit in, and The Mess, you know, nuclear war, blah, 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 blah. But we couldn't, it just didn't kind of flow. You know, we couldn't make it fit. You know, we couldn't just suddenly go, okay, well, this song relates to war in this way, that, you know, let's make up stories. So, yeah, so we decided not to.
Judging by the YouTube comments on Compulsory Hero, you know, that song means a lot to a lot of people. Have you had feedback about that song over the years?
Oh, hell yeah. And a few years back, we actually flew into Afghanistan to play for the troops over there on Australia Day. Yeah, that was obviously, you know, one of the songs that they absolutely cherished. And since then, I've kept in touch with a lot of the people that I met there, a lot of the troops, met them in various places in Australia. And, yeah, that song is almost an anthem for them, you know, which is hugely humbling, you know.
So while those four songs had all done well on the singles chart, the album Ish did even better, didn't it, Robbie?
It certainly did. Ish spent 4 weeks at number one and most of 1989 inside the top 50. By the year end, it was Australia's second biggest album, just behind the Traveling Wilburys. To say it was huge would be an understatement. Ish went 5 times platinum, meaning it had sold over 350,000 copies. A fifth single, To Love Me, completed the single release schedule, and whilst it didn't make the top 50, it didn't really need to. It was a big radio track and a fan favourite. Let's have a listen, and then Eric will talk about all that success.
Was it just incomprehensible that the album had done so well?
Oh, absolutely. All of it was incomprehensible. I mean, how long did you say that album was in the charts for? Like a long time, right?
I think it was 45 weeks in the top 50.
I mean, that's crazy. Look, it took a few years for it to really, really sink in, to be honest with you. For the most time, it was all just pure bewilderment.
How did you cope with that instant fame and, you know, being a pinup in magazines and that kind of stuff?
It was two things. It was surreal, firstly, because it happened really quickly. One moment we were playing in Tumbalong Park in Darling Harbour on a Sunday afternoon on an empty stage to nobody, and like literally 6 months later, walking out of entertainment centres with people going absolutely bazonkers. So that was bizarre. But the other part of it was that suddenly I couldn't bloody do anything. I couldn't go down to the shop without having people chasing me down the street, and I couldn't go to an Italian restaurant to have some dinner because everybody in the place knew who I was, and so they were staring at me and wanted photos and da-da-da-da-da. And it was a bloody horrifying. So, I kind of stopped going out.
Was it something that I guess you were able to separate as you had, you know, that's that guy? Were you able to package that as part of, well, that's Eric, the performer, it's not me?
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, on the other hand, I wasn't even allowed to be me, just, you know, the dude who's, okay, I need to go down to the local shop to buy a carton of milk because they don't see me, they see that guy. So, yeah.
1927 wasted no time moving on to their second album, The Other Side, with work beginning in late 1989. But then, just like all good pop fairy tales, something very unexpected happened.
It sure did. Founding member Gary Frost, that's right, the man who recruited Eric, the man who travelled to Melbourne to pitch his case in person and had written or co-written much of Ish, he decided to leave 1927. Robbie, that's a pretty big spanner in the works, right?
Absolutely. I mean, what's going on? Especially if it's one of the founding members of the group, Gary would have been the glue that bonded the band together initially. So it would have taken a lot of getting used to for Eric and the remaining members of 1927. Let's get Eric's perspective on Gary leaving.
It confused the hell out of all of us when all this went down, because it was kind of out of nowhere, you know, and it was like, why do you want to go now? We're all just having such a good time and everything's going really well. But I don't think things were going the way that he envisaged them going, so he had his reasons. And yeah, I mean, you know, we really didn't want it to happen because it's like, oh God, you know, come on. Because I guess for a lot of the time, he was still a person that we all kind of, I don't know if it looked up to is the right word, but you know, he was kind of a compass in a way, because none of us, we were all just like, you know, the kids that had been let loose and were on this wonderful ride, but there was no one actually to show us any kind of safety barrier if he left. So it was a weird time, but you know, we got through it eventually.
Do you know what he was hoping for? Or
I think he was hoping to be more in a production capacity on that record and perhaps the next. I don't know, but that seemed to be something that he really, really wanted to do. And it was like, well, we have a record producer, so. Yeah, and none of us really saw the point.
Right. So was it more something between Gary and Charles?
Quite possibly. Yeah. Yeah. For us it was just, you know, it's time for me to go. And that was it. So I was like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it must have almost like pulled the rug out from under you.
Yeah, well, none of us had any clue that it was going to happen. And, you know, we were already into the recording process of the next record, and it was like, well, who the hell walks out now? You know?
So with him being out of the equation, what did that mean for you? Did you step up more into more of like a leadership role?
No, that was forced upon me because, you know, I guess I was the front guy of the band, but that's not how I like things to be. When it's a band, I mean, it's a group effort. It should always remain a democracy, a group effort. There shouldn't be just a single person that's responsible for all the decisions or whatever else, because what's the point otherwise? So that made it kind of uncomfortable for me, and I was always kind of butting against the whole idea of being a leader of a band, which kind of was self-alienating for me, because it was like, I don't want this. I need you guys to be here, not over there. Yeah, that ultimately caused a massive chasm between myself and the rest of the band. And that was just not a fun working environment.
Okay, so despite such a massive road bump, the band forged ahead with The Other Side, and its first single, Tell Me a Story, was actually a track written by Gary. Let's have a listen.
Released in the May of 1990, Tell Me a Story is a big track with a big production behind it, and it was received relatively well, peaking at number 17 on the charts. Not quite the dizzy heights you'd expect for their first new single, but a good start.
And Tell Me a Story was followed by Don't Forget Me, and that one stalled at number 42, possibly because the album had just been released and maybe people bought that instead. Here's Don't Forget Me.
The Other Side peaked at number 3 and went platinum, figures many bands would kill for. But compared to Ish and its singles, it was a bit of a come down. I personally believe the second LP was probably released possibly a year too early. I mean, Ish had been so successful and was still smouldering, so to speak. People weren't ready for the second album, just yet perhaps. Having said that, it was a good record, and the title track is definitely my favourite cut from the LP.
Yeah, I think you may be onto something there. It did feel very quick to be getting another album. There is something for striking while the iron's hot, but yes, possibly was too much too soon, especially with Gary having left. Maybe that would have been a good time to, okay, let's regroup and then move forward.
Let's get this right. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. In terms of the songs, I feel like Tell Me a Story and Don't Forget Me were solid. They were very consistent with 1927 sound, and they maybe even moved it forward slightly, but I don't feel like they had the magic that those early hits did. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. They're good songs, but there's just something about them that's just not quite single material.
Rousing, Tell Me a Story's really kind of got the, one love.
And a lot of work went into them. You can just tell the production behind them was big and they thought, we've got to go bigger.
And Don't Forget Me's got the, that glory, glory, hallelujah bit at the end. Again, really rousing and kind of anthemic. Maybe it wasn't the best idea to try and get lightning to strike twice so quickly.
Yeah, so soon. Yeah, I agree.
All right, let's hear Eric reflect on this album. Was putting The Other Side together a similar process or not, because the dynamic had shifted so much?
No, it was exactly the same.
Another enjoyable experience.
Oh, absolutely. Every day that I spent in the studio with Charles, I was learning something about music, about sound, the way sound works, about myself. And it was just a great time in my life, great time.
And you wrote 4 of the songs on that album yourself, as well as a few co-writes. How were you feeling about your songwriting at that stage? Were you more confident in it?
I think I was, yeah. And I'd learned along the way, like I was saying, a lot from Charles and from Gary. And so, I felt like I was getting better at it. And ultimately it was, a record company choice as to which songs made the album cut. And I was pleased.
Now, so it was always going to be difficult to match the success of Ish because it was such a phenomenon. Were people happy with how it did, or was there a sense of disappointment?
No, there wasn't a sense of disappointment on our front at all. I mean, the press was as you would expect the press to be, it's not the album that Ish was, and, how do you follow that up and blah, blah, blah. But, we all knew that anyway. There's only the select few that will go from a, 5-6 times platinum album to a 10 times platinum album in the next one. So, we were happy with the album. We were happy with the way things were going. It was just, some not negative, but not positive press. You know what I mean?
Was it, I guess, falling foul of the tall poppy syndrome?
Yeah, that term was thrown around a lot, and I never understood what it meant, you know, this tall poppy syndrome thing. So, that was definitely thrown around. Me personally, it was just like, well, you know, I'm not complaining. I've got another platinum album on my wall, you know. That's fine by me.
There was another lineup change coming into 1927's self-titled third album. Drummer James Barton left and was replaced by Philip Campbell, and that wasn't the only big difference for this album, was it?
No, indeed. 1927 worked with a different producer on this album. The record company chose Mark Opitz. That's a name we're all familiar with, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, INXS, Divinyls, The Hoodoo Gurus, AC/DC. This guy has done some of the biggest names in Australian music.
Yeah, Cold Chisel as well, Noiseworks, so many classic Australian albums. So it made a lot of sense to put him with 1927.
Why on earth not?
Should have been a musical marriage made in pop rock heaven, but it wasn't something Eric was too pleased about, as it would turn out.
We'll hear Eric talk about that just in a moment, but first, let's have a quick listen to the first single from that self-titled third album. This is called Scars.
Yeah, oh look, that was not a good experience for me. Firstly, because I didn't understand the record company's decision to change producers, because I wanted to work with Charles Fisher, but they wanted us to work with Mark Opitz, and they wanted to record somewhere else. So we're in Rhinoceros Studio, the big studio in Sydney, and we're used to recording in a nice little Trafalgar studio. So that was strange. And then we had Mark Opitz, who we didn't know, and turned out, you know, didn't care much about producing music more than playing table tennis while we were trying to work it out. So yeah, it was a rotten experience. And I think the record is reflective of that, because yeah, I wasn't very happy with it at all.
And so what prompted the change of producer? Why did the record company insist on that?
Something about, you know, maybe it's a good idea to work with another producer to see where the progression of 1927 goes. Valid point, given, you know, I give them that. But there should at least have been a kind of introductory period or something, or let's try something first to see if it works before we commit, but that didn't happen. So, and as it turns out, the guy, you know, his reputation preceded him, but and this is just me, personal, I'm not bagging the guy, but my experience with Mark Opitz was not a good one.
What was your, or the band's, but I guess also your relationship like with the record company?
Well, the main thing was that record companies were changing, and all the head offices in America that, you know, had labels here, like WEA, who we were leased through, you know, Warner's essentially, were basically pulling back on their A&R budgets and advertising budgets and blah, 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 blah. So they were really, the record companies were becoming very corporate and under the control of head office in the States. So lots of things were poo-pooed and vetoed, and things that were available before, like tour support advances and money for videos and all that sort of thing, were suddenly pulled. So it just became a more sterile environment, I guess, because all the really cool A&R guys that used to hang out with the bands and talk about direction and videos and whatever else, they lost their jobs. So yeah, it just changed.
You know, the music had changed a lot between 1988 and 1992 as well.
That's right.
Were you feeling that?
All of us were, like, you know, Ice House and, you know, bands of our genre. It was like, well, where do we fit in anymore? Yeah, well, we kind of didn't really, you know, to be honest. Because, you know, radio was all over, you know, the new stuff. And, you know, rightfully so. I mean, it was fresh. It was new. It's the cycle of music. New things happen and stuff goes by the wayside.
I mean, obviously in 1991, U2 had, I guess, taken a huge leap with Achtung Baby. They'd been very pop rock in the 80s and then completely pivoted. Was that something that anyone ever said, oh, maybe you should do an Achtung Baby or something like that?
I've quite often thought about doing that myself, but you have to be realistic. Whereas, you know, U2, and, you know, talking about that Achtung Baby record, I mean, what a record that was when I first heard it, because I was a big, big, big U2 fan. But the moment I heard that record, I was absolutely floored. I was like, wow, how do you do that? you know, because it was quite a feat to go from who they were to what that record, you know, what they were on that record. It was so different. And I honestly don't think that a 1927 audience would digest that.
Scars, I thought, was a great choice of lead single. What's the story behind that song?
Oh, look, you know, I had a rotten first marriage, and a lot of songs were born out of that, that being one of them.
When was that marriage?
The last 8 years of the 90s, yeah, 92 to 2000.
Oh, so when Scars was written, that was early on in that relationship.
Yeah, it went south real quick.
The band split after this album, and you've already, I guess, alluded to some of the factors that were at play, but what brought about the ultimate demise of 1927 at that point?
Well, you know, apart from what I mentioned earlier, I was just tired of the lack of control. Not that I'm a control freak, but, you know, there are certain things that you should at least have a say in, and it was just never like that. You know, it was always, this is how it's going to go, and so that's how it went. And, yeah, I just didn't want to live my life like that anymore. I wanted to kind of feel like I was a little bit more in control of my life. And, yeah, I wasn't happy with the dynamic in the band, and I just thought it could have been a lot better than it was at that stage. But there was just too many differing opinions. A couple of guys in the band liked to party too much, and it was just, it was too destructive. So it was just better not to to do it for a while. I initially intended just to kind of take a break for a couple of years, but I just couldn't find any good reason to get back into that scene again, you know.
With all that upheaval and not the same level of success, the album peaked at number 40, Scars reached number 46, and second single, It Ain't Love, failed to make the top 100. It's no surprise 1927 split up in 1993.
But to celebrate the musical legacy of the group, Warner Records released the very best of 1927 in 1996. Now, that collection included a couple of new tracks, one of which was Eric's solo song, Nothing I Can Do. But when released as a single in early 97, it only got as far as number 73 on the charts.
Yeah, it seemed like there might have been some hopes of a solo career for Eric, but it wasn't to be. Here's what he had to say about what happened there.
Being approached to get a solo career going, which I thought, yeah, I'll give that a go, because I really didn't want to do the 1927 thing again. And they decided that that would be a good tune, and I think there was another one as well, to tap on the back of the very best of. Just to kind of be, because not many people know the name Eric Wiedemann, you know, so they wanted to make a connection there, I guess. But that fell victim to the usual, well, we don't have budgets for this and we don't want to do that. It's just like, this again. Thanks, see ya.
With Eric taking a lengthy break from the music scene, it seemed like that was the end of the 1927 story. But as is so often the case, you can't keep a good performer off the stage forever. In 2009, to mark the 20th anniversary of Ish, Eric put a new backing band together and took 1927 on the road for an Australian tour.
And he's been doing that pretty much ever since. Mm. And there's been some new music as well. In 2013, there was the Generation I album. And in 2019, an EP, Paper Aeroplane, both of which you can find on a streaming service near you.
Hey, I haven't had a chance to mention it, but I must say that Eric Wiedemann, look, he had one of the best blow waves of the 80s. Come on, that guy gave me hair envy. But aside from that, on a serious note, I did get the chance to see the new incarnation of 1927 do their thing live, and it was seriously a special moment. I have to mention that that's when I think of you sounded amazing, and the crowd reaction and reception was just phenomenal.
I think any time 1927 play even the album tracks from Ish, people respond really well. Because that album sold so many copies, we're familiar with, you know, we had a copy in my house. We're familiar not only with those five singles, but the other five tracks as well, many of which could have been singles.
Yep.
Everyone knows them. It's, you know, really is a classic album. And I think it's still among the highest selling debut albums in Australian history.
And I believe If I Could is one of the highest selling singles in this country as well. And to release five singles off one album, I mean, who does that? We're talking Michael Jackson territory, you know, Katy Perry, superstar status.
That's right. That's right. People love to hear those songs on the radio, but more importantly, love to hear them in concert, which is a good thing because, 1927.
He's back on tour.
Are on the road.
He's going to be playing right across Australia over the next 6 months. And of course, you know, just head to 1927.net.au and all the details are up there.
Excellent. Now, you can hear the full interview with Eric in the bonus material for this episode, and you can find that at chartbeats.com.au/Aussie, where you can subscribe for all the bonus material. And as always, always, please rate and review our show on Spotify and Apple Music. And it would also be great if you could tell any fellow Aussie pop fans about our show. Send them a link, tag them in one of our social media posts, help us get the word out there. Am I sounding too desperate, Robbie?
Not at all. Look, I mean, we want to really embrace Aussie pop music. We want the stars to also know that they're remembered for the contribution that they made. So yeah, super important.
Now, we're both on socials. I'm at ChartBeatsAU on Twitter and Instagram, and look for ChartBeats A Journey Through Pop on Facebook. And Robbie, where are you? You're everywhere.
I'm everywhere, man. Joy Turned Beat Around on Insta and Twitter. And of course, you can catch me every Friday night live on Joy 94.9 with Turn the Beat Around.
So we'll see you in a couple of weeks. We'll announce our next guest on those social media platforms. And yeah, Robbie's done a really interesting interview that we're hoping will be our next episode. So stay tuned for that. See you, Robbie.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.